Hope you guys have all been having a great Ignite. And I'm really actually humbled and surprised to see so many people in the audience today. It is a design talk at a developer conference. So yeah, and I really appreciate you guys coming out here. So my name is Atta Alain. And today I'm going to be talking to you guys about designing great app experiences. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background about myself. I co-founded Lazy Worm Apps in 2010. And we actually started the company focused on building apps for the very first generation of Windows Phone. And so you guys might be thinking, Lazy Worm Apps, that's a pretty weird name. And I wouldn't disagree with you, but if it's good enough for Bill, then it's good enough for us. So our first claim to fame was delivering the very first YouTube app on Windows Phone. And it's had over 1 million downloads. It's been widely recognized in the media and promoted by Microsoft and Nokia. And we've been very fortunate to get that sort of exposure by building that app. Our second claim to fame was building the first Twitter app on Windows 8. And this was actually a really, really proud moment for us. My business partner, Mike, and I were up really late at night. Can't wait to see the Windows 8 keynote. And as we were up in the wee hours of the morning in New Zealand, we were so humbled to see our app actually up on stage right next to Steve Ballmer. As you can see there, Tweetro was being promoted. So the although we did see a fair bit of success with the exposure that we received from our consumer apps, unfortunately, we never were really able to unlock the key of making money on the ecosystem. And I think some of you might be nodding your heads. And we actually had to pivot our business model, and we ended up actually offering our services. And so fast forwarding till to today, we primarily focus on helping other businesses really build great apps and great experiences. We've been really fortunate actually to work with some awesome brands here in New Zealand and abroad, and we're very proud to have actually been nominated for Startup of the Year and Windows App Developer of the Year at New Zealand's Microsoft Partner Awards. So anyway, enough blowing my trumpet, enough talking about myself. Let's talk about this session and what we're going to get into today. So I'll start off by just giving you guys a little bit of insight into what actually inspired us, what inspired us to start Lazy Worm Apps, what inspired us to start building apps for the very first generation of Windows Phone. I'm then going to talk about understanding consumers. So the process that we took when we started building our apps and how we delivered it's kind of a minimal viable product and iterated really fast until we found and started seeing success. I'll then talk about a mentorship that I received from some of the Windows Phone designers as we redesigned one of our major updates to our YouTube app. And then I'll talk about the a listener design process that we received from actually going through Microsoft's AFT design process, which is a Microsoft's process for showcasing apps. So we learned a few tips and tricks there. I'll then discuss a little bit about some of the challenges that we faced when we released Tweetro for Windows 8 for the first time. And obviously Windows 8 was, I guess, the first hybrid operating system and some of the things that we had to consider. As I suggested, we moved somewhat away from the consumer space and into the client space. And so I'll also be discussing some of the design processes that we adopted when we started working with our clients, because we can have close communication with our customers, but with clients, you actually have to get that information from them. You don't have that kind of intimate relationship with the end user. And finally, I'll talk about a topic that's kind of dear to my heart now, and it's kind of really driving what we're doing today, is this idea of the consumerization of enterprise software. And I'm going to go through a few case studies and talk about some of the work that we've been doing in the enterprise space. So why Windows Phone 7? I think that's it was a lot of people were asking us that question very early on. And Mike, he is huge. He loves technology. He loves buying the latest gadgets. And he actually pre-ordered the very first Windows Phone in New Zealand. And New Zealand was one of the very first countries in the world to receive a Windows Phone. So we were actually very lucky to be very early on to be able to play with it. And when I got to use the phone, there was a few things that really stood out for me. Obviously, I'd used Android before, and I'd used iOS, and they were amazing experiences in their own right. But there was no real innovation, I felt, in the smartphone space. Android had come out. They'd really just copied what the iPhone had. But with Windows Phone 7 and the first iteration of Windows Phone, it was fresh. It was completely new. There was this idea of, you know, just clean typography, focus on content. And it just stood out for me. And we decided, yeah, this would be something that we should, there could be potential in this platform. Another thing that really I loved when I was playing with the first generation of Windows Phone was there was a huge emphasis being placed on actually gestures. So if we contrast it with iOS, when you want to navigate the iOS operating system, a lot of it's button pushing. You know, we're dealing with a flat glass surface. The tactile feedback of pushing a real button feels nice, but on a glass surface, it's just doesn't feel natural. So when I first started playing with the panorama control and like swiping through the phone, I felt that this was pretty natural and really nice way to. So anyway, we felt that they really innovated on the design language and they innovated on what a mobile OS could be like. And that's kind of what inspired us to really get started. I later did some research and found that the reasons behind what actually inspired the Metro design language or the modern or Microsoft design language, and they were heavily inspired by the Bauhaus design school of thought and Swiss style graphic design, which is schools of thought in the early 1900s, 1950s. And what this thinking or this design thinking, basically they wanted to boil down design elements to its simplest components. So really reducing what the elements are. So for example, here we see this table. What is a table? A table is basically a tabletop and four legs. And so that's what the design ended up being. The same thing with the furniture that we look at here. It's very simplistic. If you look at the clock face, it's just very clean and it only does what it needs to do. Another really key important aspect of the Bauhaus design school of thought was this idea of efficiency. So efficiency of space and efficiency of manufacturing. The simpler the design, and the simpler it is to actually mass produce. And obviously it takes up a lot less space. So this kind of design thought kind of inspired the Microsoft designers when they were coming through. Swiss style design is hugely influential in transportation signage. And the idea of, okay, well, when you go to an airport, what is your main goals? You want to get to your gate as soon as possible. You're not walking, oh, that's a beautiful sign. You're not really thinking about the details of that sign. You want to get from A to B as quickly as you can. And so the Swiss style design language really helped promote this concept of great typography and very visual and easy way to consume that information. So, all right, that's all good and fine. Let's look at the contrast of this design style. So if we look at the furniture here, it's huge level of ornamentation. I mean, it's beautiful, it's crafted. You can tell there's a lot of effort being put into it, but you almost feel like, what are you looking at? You walk into this room and everything's shouting at you, and you don't feel that sense of simplicity. And you can imagine that making this kind of furniture is probably highly, highly complicated and will take a lot of time. And the same thing when you're at the Las Vegas Strip, you know, you're trying to get to A to B, every single casino is shouting at you, come join us, come. So it's really the opposite of that thinking. And in fact, this is akin to what skeuomorphism is, or the old design languages of, say, iOS, where there is a lot of gradients, a lot of drop shadows, a lot of extra information being pushed onto these icons, whereas really we just wanted the basics and the basic information. So you're thinking that, all right, well, that's the Microsoft design language is all good and fine, but these design principles now have become ubiquitous. They're everywhere. If we're designing on iOS, if we're designing on Android, if we're designing on web, this kind of design thinking is really important. And so I just wanted to highlight that we should all try and really understand the reasonings behind it. So here we can see iOS 7 when it was introduced. Material design, it's all now the same, a very similar look and feel. Right, so moving on to understanding consumers. When we first started to think about what is the app that we're gonna build for Windows Phone, I started to play around with the phone and looked at the store. The store was pretty sparse. There wasn't much on there. And the YouTube app was actually a link to m.youtube.com. And so I thought, oh, that's great. That's a really cool entry point to actually building an app. And what we did is we did exactly that. We built a YouTube app. But the key point that I want to get across is we actually built a minimum viable product. It's just something that we can get out there quickly. It took us about 3 weeks to get onto the store. And it was simply a way to search for YouTube videos and look through some of the links. By getting it out quickly, we were able to communicate with our users, and then we would iterate. Every sort of two weeks to 1 month, we would push out another update, listen to feedback, push out another update, and until we started seeing real success. And it took us almost a year before we really started getting proper traction. But we got it out early. So how do we communicate with our customers? How do we actually understand what do they want, and how did we innovate on our experience. We use tools like DevCenter, so we'd go through and we'd read all of the reviews and really try and understand what are people saying about each build. We looked at Twitter and we put out all these multiple search terms around our product, searching on our product name, searching on people talking about YouTube on Windows Phone, people talking about our competitors. So we tried to really get a good grasp about what was going on. We would also constantly search for the latest articles and latest blog posts that had our branding in it or had stuff about our product. And the key thing I think that really helped us move forward here was the fact that we didn't only consume content. We didn't only just look at these reviews. We would engage with these customers or we would engage with our end users. That helped us understand exactly what is it their problem that they're trying to or what is it that they want. But at the same time, it actually helped create people who are really fans of our product. They loved what they could clearly see that we cared about it. And so it's this back and forth engagement that really helped us. So there's sometimes you can't take sometimes you shouldn't take this to heart. Like, don't take it too personally. But sometimes you'll get reviews.
Are you f***ing kidding me? I can't f***ing sign in, and I have to buy your shitty app to do so. F*** you, lazy worm. What the f*** is stopping me from going to YouTube on Explorer and signing in for free? You don't get to make people pay for using f***ing YouTube, you prick. The reason I want a f***ing YouTube app is so that I can sign in and watch videos quickly and without loading 5 pages before I get to what I want. That is so annoying on so many levels. Why is everything on Windows Phone so expensive? This phone could actually compete with the iPhone if it wasn't for people like you, lazy f*** face worm.
So, yeah. Thank you. So this guy actually spent, you know, a good maybe 15 minutes writing this up. We got to have thick skin sometimes when we were looking at these reviews. So sometimes you have to take them with a grain of salt. The funny thing is actually the app was a donation. Like, we didn't even charge for it. It was like you only had to pay if you wanted to. So, but yeah, so be cautious of the keyboard warriors. So a lesson in Metro. Windows Phone Mango came out, and we wanted to really kind of redesign the entire application so that it would take advantage of the new operating system. And we got really excited about it, and I spent a lot of time thinking about how the redesign was going to look like, and I came up with these awesome screens, and I was super pumped, and I thought, yeah, the users are going to love it. But returning to the importance of communicating with customers, I actually received an email from this chap called Ron Manlapaz. And Ron, actually, he was one of the Windows Phone designers who worked on the Windows Phone design team. He was using our app, and he wanted some feedback or some support. And what Mike actually cleverly ended up doing was saying, hey, Ron, we're going through a redesign. Would you like to help us? Could you potentially mentor us with our redesign? So I was like, yeah, awesome. Ron's going to see my awesome work, and it's all going to be sweet. Unfortunately, however way you look at it, Ron ripped my design to shreds. So there was a lot of things that I did wrong, and I didn't really properly understand what it meant to design modern UIs. So here, if we look at this screen, this was the playback control. Now, there's a couple of things that he pointed out. One is there's a hierarchy here. The most important thing on the screen has to be play and pause. And although I had it large, I put it off to the left. And so it was what happens when someone wanted to use the right thumb to interact with it. But more importantly than that, I was using a mixture of design principles here, or design thoughts. One was obviously the modern design. You can the play and pause, the repeat, the expand, the HD button. They're all using this flat, simplistic style. But what about the scrubber and the volume control? I've got gradients and drop shadows, and it looks like this little nice lozenge. And the thing is, because it's different from everything else, it takes commands the focus. So as soon as you look at the player control, you are looking at the volume control, or you're looking at the scrubber, whereas those aren't actually the most important things on the screen. So what I did to rectify this after his awesome feedback was I unified the design in that now it's all using this modern design thinking. So we've swapped the scrubber out for a normal circle ring with a little point. And it's clear now when you jump into the screen that the hierarchy is obvious. Play and pause is first, scrubber maybe probably second, and then next and previous, and then the rest of the controls. So it made it very easy. And also, looking at that screen, it's put a lot of focus on the actual video itself. So the second bit of feedback that he had for me And it was kind of sad for me too, because I spent probably a few days thinking about this experience, thinking it was going to be awesome. I wanted to do something unique with the rating slider. So when you thumb something up or down, I wanted to kind of mimic the action of thumbs up and thumbs down. And so he said, look, you know, this is you've made the same mistake that you made in the previous screen, where the actual rating slider has these gradients and drop shadows, and it's commanding attention where it shouldn't, because it's not the most important thing on the screen. And also, what's interesting here is I used a gesture. So I wanted to gesture down for dislike and gesture up for like, but what's the problem? The problem is, what if we wanted to scroll the actual screen? So I had conflicting gestures in the same interface, and you could potentially accidentally like something or dislike it when you scroll. Here's a similar problem with that. In my settings screens, I had a slider toggle, but that was in a pivot control. So you could turn notifications off, but actually navigate to the next screen. So to fix that, what I did was remove the rating slider and even the rating slider concept entirely of this whole thumbing up and thumbing down, made it simple buttons. And what it also did was it freed up the width of the UI so that I can focus on the content, which was the video. The next thing that I got some feedback on was I was trying to come up with a homepage and leverage this new panorama template that Microsoft had pushed out. And I was throwing content everywhere and lots of, is that the right one? Yeah, it is. So I was overloading the panorama with content, and I was kind of treating it, I was trying to make too many actions in here. And so the advice that they gave me was, the panorama should be, you should think of a panorama control like a magazine. And when we redesigned it, we put a lot more, that is really, look, man, I'm nervous enough as it is, man. Come on. Gee. Okay. All right. Remember. What was I talking about? Okay. So panorama, magazine, it has to be, we're trying to, when you're building a panorama control, you should think about a magazine. It should be suggestive, and it should be trying to tease the user to navigate. And that's kind of, if you can contrast it with the previous screen, that was being too busy, too focused, whereas this one, it's very suggestive. So, and with Windows 10, we've got the hub control, and that's kind of a similar paradigm to what the panorama is. So if you're going to build hub controls, you want to try and make sure that you keep it very simple and very suggestive. And if you want to get into efficiency, you should use a pivot control or, let's say, a master detail page. If you think of Windows 10 Outlook, it uses the master detail type principle, and that's kind of what we want to do. The next thing that I was doing wrong was I didn't even know that there was a grid that existed or that we needed to design to a grid. And Ron came to me and said, look, you know, your designs look nice, but it seems like they're out of alignment in certain places. I came to find out that there is a design grid. And once I applied it, the app felt like it was baked into the ecosystem because it's actually using that. And so whether you're developing on iOS, Android, Windows 10, there is a design grid, and you should try and apply these grids. The final bit of advice that he had was, I was pretty haphazard with how I was doing my UIs. So if someone wanted to filter something, I came up with my own filtering UI. If someone wanted to log in, I came up with my own login UI. So what Ron came back to me and said, look, don't reinvent the wheel. If there's a system there already in the operating in the ecosystem, why don't you just reuse it? And so I went through and I changed all of my screens that I felt were too out there. And stuck to the conventions. And so when we ended up actually releasing MetroTube, we renamed it and we pushed it out as MetroTube. It was a huge hit, and we're really proud of the work that we did, but we couldn't have done it without the awesome feedback from the guys at Microsoft. But what happened was a lot of the success of MetroTube was because it felt like a native YouTube experience made for Windows Phone, and that's kind of the biggest feedback that we got. Lessons in design process. So we were fortunate enough that we got tapped on the shoulder by Microsoft when Windows 8 was coming to fruition, and they said, look, you know, do you guys want to try and come up with an app that we could showcase for, I think it was Consumer Preview. And of course, we were super excited about that, and we decided that we'd start tackling a Twitter app, and we would build the first Twitter app on Windows 8. Now, it was all good to come out with a Twitter app, but Microsoft had a very strict process. They weren't just going to let anyone showcase the app because the marketplace wasn't actually open to everyone. They were going to pick a few apps to push out. And this, they had this process called the AFT process, which we had to go through, and it was very, very stringent. And they needed We had to come up with a document that stated, you know, what was unique about our application, how was it going to be distinguished, what made it amazing, and they wanted every single screen, every single process flow, how the user would navigate, and we had to come up with this document here before they would even accept us to get into the development process. We even had to do every single state of the screen, so when you rotated it, how did it look like when you snapped it? They really wanted a full end-to-end type visual. And so this really taught us a few things. Like traditionally, Mike and I, when we started building apps, we would just kind of hack something together, do a quick design and push it out and iterate, and that was good. But for us to get to MetroTube, it took us almost a year and a bit. But Tweetra was almost, I wouldn't say an instant hit, but we put a lot of thought, and this forced us to put a lot of thought into the experience, and we ended up cutting down the development time a lot. And this is something that I highly recommend. You probably don't need to do something as detailed as this, but definitely you want to be fleshing out your user experience in this kind of form very early on. So when we launched Tweetro, we made, I wouldn't say a mistake, but we didn't realize that I was one of the very few people who had a touchscreen at the time that ran the Microsoft operating system. And so everyone who was using Tweetro was actually using it on mouse and keyboard. And the problem with that is, you know, I hadn't even considered the mouse and keyboard experience somewhat, but I didn't think that it would be that important. So this is something that really holds true now for Windows 10. And if we're looking to build Windows 10 apps, it's absolutely essential that we consider how our users are going to use it. What are the input methods that are going to be used? Touch, mouse, and keyboard. And finally, it's going to be resized, so it needs to be very fluid and adapts to all these different screens. So it's just something to consider. So we knew how to build apps for our own consumers, but as I said, we pivoted our business and we started building apps for others. And the problem is we didn't have an intimate connection with the end users. We had to, when we started working with clients, we had to tweak our design process so that we could better understand, you know, who are these end users. So I'd like to share a case study that we recently did with TradeMe to showcase this design process that we adopted. So TradeMe, for those, I'm sure everyone here is familiar with TradeMe, but those who aren't, it started off as a used auction website, and it's actually now more than 50% of sales on TradeMe are brand new goods. And so they wanted to, for this particular app that we were building for them on Windows Phone, they wanted to explore methods to raise awareness for the fact that TradeMe also is a new goods shopping experience, or can facilitate a new goods shopping experience. But they didn't want to risk putting this kind of app onto iOS and Android because it's far too difficult and far too risky to come up. They haven't really explored this kind of thing before. So we really sat down with them and tried to really understand who's going to use this product, why are they using it, what are the goals for TradeMe for releasing it on Windows Phone, etc. And so we set up a few goals for the app, and one was we would deliver a purely new goods shopping experience, so focused on only new goods. A success metric would be we would increase the net purchases of new goods sold on Windows Phone, and it would have the lowest abandonment rate or lowest shopping cart abandonment rate out of any TradeMe application. And those were the goals that we set for ourselves when we went into this. And finally, it would have to act as a minimum viable product so that when TradeMe eventually wanted to support a full-blown version. So they wanted to sort of hit two birds with one stone. So after we understood the vision, we started to brainstorm and work closely with them to understand a very high-level approach. All right, what could this app possibly look like? And similar to that process that I was talking to you guys about before with AFT, we used that to come up with user flows and information architecture just to give a very rough idea of how we're going to tackle this problem. What this enabled us to do was also constantly align with them because we needed their validation. We needed to make sure that our vision was in line with their vision. So when it came to solving the nitty-gritty problems, once we'd agreed on the overall structure, we're talking about a new goods shopping experience. And so what we did is we went to the mall and we tried to understand, okay, what is it that constitutes a new goods shopping experience? What triggers are there that showcase this? And it's hindsight obviously seems very obvious, but new goods, normally when you see big brands and when you see discount prices and sales and this kind of terminology, you think new goods. And so we wanted to really bake that into the experience and make that the forefront of when they log in, when they see the app. So here we can see the design that we came up with. We had like a previous price and a now price showcasing a discount. We put a lot of emphasis on well-known brands so that when the user opened up this application, it sort of really promoted the fact that it was about new goods and not auctions and used stuff. So here we can see the final design. Once again, you can see the focus on brands and elements there. So the next challenge was a little bit tougher. How are we going to reduce the abandonment rates? How are we going to increase net purchases of new goods on Windows Phone? So that's another thing we did. We went and observed, what are the shopping behavior? When you go shopping, why is it that when you actually get to the checkout, more often than not, you make that purchase? And so we're just trying to internalize these things. And the things that we thought and brainstormed and came up with is, all right, well, the shopping cart is there, or the cart that you use is always there. It's always with you. You can glance down and see it at any point in time. It's effortless to put something in and take it out at any point. You don't have to buy it at that specific moment. And so by the time you actually end up reaching the checkout, you're validated exactly what you want, and you're quite comfortable with your purchase. And so we wanted to replicate this kind of thinking digitally. And so what we thought is, okay, well, the traditional shopping cart is, you watch list what you want, or you add what you want to the cart, and then you go to the shopping cart and you never return. You're forced to make a decision. We wanted to flip that on its head, and so we said, right, no matter where you are in the app, when you're browsing content, you can always swipe in from the right and get your shopping cart and see it. And you can effortlessly get it out of the way. It's not forcing you to complete anything at the time. It's almost like a watch list more than anything. We tried to reduce the level of friction that people have to add it to the cart. And the final point is, everything to do with adding to the cart, we had it like very low level friction, so we didn't have anything to do with buy or purchase or anything like that. So here we can see the final design. You can either click on the icon, or you can effortlessly swipe in from the right and get your shopping cart content and see how it's overlaid. So you immediately can try to just replicate that idea. So the final point we wanted to do was reduce abandonment rates. So how would we do that? One strategy that we used was the price that we showed the user was the total inclusive price. So anything that's to do with shipping, they weren't going to get any surprises when they ended up going to make their purchase. We saved credit card details, saved address details, and we had this kind of idea of one click purchase. The final, I guess, piece of the puzzle for us was branding. Branding was really, really important. You have to consider that this was an ecosystem that didn't have a native TradeMe experience. And so we didn't want users going and expecting to see a native TradeMe experience, because if they expected they were going to get TradeMe, immediately they're going to be disappointed. So we spent a lot of time and thought into how are we going to rebrand this app so that it kind of sets the user's expectations in some way. We worked really closely with the awesome designers at TradeMe, and we came up with something that was still TradeMe-esque, but also unique to this mall concept. So to recap on the design process that I was talking about, especially when you're dealing with clients, the first step is to sit down and really try and understand what are the goals, what is the vision, who are the users of this application, and really internalize what is the problem that we're trying to solve. The second step is to have a very high-level overview of how the app is going to function and try and work very closely with the team to get that across. And then we'd sketch out all of these different ideas and work very closely with them to validate that our design and our thinking is the same as theirs and is in line with theirs. And the final, step before development is high-level, high-fidelity prototypes. So pixel-perfect designs of every single screen, exactly how, similar to the AFT process that I was talking to you before, exactly how the user is going to navigate, exactly what happens in that experience. And the final point is what we do is we make sure that from the very first sketch, from the very first iteration of design, we make sure to include developers. And we make sure that the developers are there with us, actually brainstorming with us and helping us come to that final design. Because the last thing you want to do is come up with a design that they don't want to deliver or they can't deliver. And so we make sure that the development or the developers are always there. And by the time they get to this stage, they're actually quite invested. If you include them early on, they're very invested in this. And they'll really give you the extra mile to put out the experience that you're hoping for. So UX designers, we strive for delivering balanced solutions. So what do I mean by a balanced solution? And for anyone UX designers in here? Okay, awesome. Okay, so as UX designers, we strive for balanced solutions, and developers, you know, they may have certain constraints, and so if you're purely focusing on the developer side, if you look at the bottom one here, which is if you're a development advocate, you may not actually end up achieving the user's needs or the business needs because the developer might not know or might not want to deliver this particular experience. Same thing with the business. The business might want a certain thing that clashes with the user. A good example is YouTube. And when you go on YouTube, you see an advertisement. Now, no user wants to see an advertisement on YouTube, but it's a business requirement that they do that because if they can't make money, they can't sustain their business. And so as a UX designer, you need to constantly be wrestling between the business needs and the user needs and, of course, the development constraints. And so TradeMe was actually somewhat of a case study or a good case study that highlights this because at the end of the day, users want a full-blown TradeMe experience, but TradeMe had constraints that they couldn't deliver one straight off the bat like that. And this is the current state of the reviews of the app, and I would have liked to see it higher, obviously, but I think in context of the challenge that we had, we did quite well. So if we look at, let's say, David's comment here, he says, fast, functional, well done, an original TradeMe app would be great too. So he does have that need of a TradeMe app, but he's still very happy with the experience that he received, and that's ultimately, I think, a win on our part. And I think just last thing to note was that the one stars are very similar to that video that we showed before. You know, it's just people being keyboard warriors. Oh, no motors. Well, it's TradeMe Mall. It's a different type of app entirely. So the consumerization of enterprise software. Okay. This is probably the state of a lot of line of business and enterprise applications. As I said, now we're more and more starting to deal with enterprise customers and line of business apps, and we're seeing this, not quite this bad, right? But we're seeing this a lot. And it's you can understand the thinking behind it, right? Management would say, right, the customer is not gonna see these applications. We can train our staff to use this type of product, and that's fair, but I think that it's a little bit short-sighted because it's an unsustainable way of thinking in today's world. I think in the keynote, we remember, they said, they had a stat up there, said 18 to 35-year-olds are dominating the workforce now, and everyone is using mobile. So, you know, these people are used to great user experiences. They're used to using awesome applications that are easy to use, they look beautiful, and so how are they gonna feel when they turn up to work and they see this application that's extremely difficult to use and annoying? And so I think that it's something that is going to change. There's going to be a lot of, I think, work in this space in the enterprise sector. So I'd just like to share some case studies with you guys around some of the line of business apps that we have built today. And this app we built for, hopefully it's working, for the Ports of Auckland, where we digitized a whole bunch of their paper-based systems. And you can see it's a very simple application, but we're still putting a lot of focus on trying to use good typography, use the grid, you know, come up with a design that's beautiful and easy and nice to look at. Here you can see, you know, there's branded, it's branded. They can, when they log in, it's got a nice experience there. And also we use animations, not just for the sake of making it look fancy, but to actually confirm that the task has been successfully synced to the server and it's really helping them give a good system state. And so the next case study that I'd like to share with you is some of the work that we've done with RMX. So RMX is an international courier company primarily based in the Middle East. They're actually really huge. They've got 12,000 offices, 33,000 vehicles, and 66,000 employees, and they service over 240 countries. And up until this point, or before we started working with RMX, pretty much every single project that we've taken on, myself as a designer and most of my designers, were quite aware or could empathize quite easily with the end user. YouTube, Twitter, TradeMe, even Ports of Auckland is a very simple business process that we did for them, so we could easily empathize with how the end user is going to use it. But RMX wanted us to reinvent their line of business application, which was on Windows Mobile C 6.5 for couriers. None of us had been couriers. We had no idea about logistics, and all of the documentation that they that they threw at us might as well have been in Swahili. Like, I couldn't understand any of the, seriously, like, it was just, and so it wasn't going to, we weren't very difficult to bridge that gap. And so we needed to tweak our process once again so that we can understand and design the right, or solve the right problems and not just come up with a problem that we envisaged in our minds. So how do we do that? In UX terms, we call this contextual inquiry. And so what we did is I spent several weeks as a courier driver, and I actually went out with them on field and saw, observed them using their systems and observed the challenges that they faced, observed their environment as well, and just tried to link in my perception of what we were going to deliver with the reality of the ground and the reality of how they were going to actually use this particular product. So just a few things that we spotted. It's in hindsight, it's obvious as well, but scanning was an integral, essential part of what they were doing. And not just that, they were actually using an infrared scanner. So we wanted to use a $200 smartphone camera to detect the barcode, which the infrared scanners look beep, 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 beep. It's like super quick, but doing a barcode scanning might not necessarily be that quick. So immediately I started seeing challenges. Whereas when we initially looked at the scope, I was like, yeah, that's easy. We'll just put barcode API and it'll be all good. The other thing that hit me like a ton of bricks was when I started seeing the packages that they're actually scanning. If we look at this package, look at the reflection on the barcode here. You try and do that on a camera detection. So all this idea of us just plugging in a barcode scanning API, it quickly sort of fell to pieces. And it wasn't all doom and gloom, because I did realize there was some situations where I saw they would want to call up a customer. And so to call up a customer, they would be driving, and then they'd, you know, park up on the side, and they'd scan the package, find the customer number, get their phone, and try and plug in the telephone number. And sometimes they were doing it while they were driving, which, you know, I was really fearing for my life. And don't forget, we're in the Middle East here as well, so these guys are, no, I'm kidding. yeah, so it was interesting. So my point is, we were actually going to revolutionize the way they were going to do things, because now they didn't need to scan and manually input that number. We could do a one-click call or a one-click text or even a one-click route navigate, because we're going to use a smartphone. So what I said is, okay, well, if we're not going to win on the infrared scanning part because we had hardware limitations, at least we're going to win on the UX front and help them. The overall picture of their day is going to get better by using our application. But like I say, I couldn't have thought about these things if I hadn't actually gone on the field and did their job with them. So the main challenge was scanning, by far. And so I'm just going to go through some of the things that our thought process of how we solved it from a UX perspective. Like I said, we're very limited by hardware. There's not much we can do there. And their specification for this project was it had to be under $200. So yes, everyone thinks, oh, just put in a Bluetooth scanner. Wasn't allowed. They wanted just to rely on the phone itself. So we sketched out a bunch of different ideas around how we were the overall picture and how we were going to re-architect this. And don't forget, like, Windows Embedded Handheld, Windows C6.5 is a completely different operating system to Windows Embedded, Windows Phone. And the input methods are completely different as well. So they were previously using a pen stylus to get their job done. Now they were going to use a touch screen. So we actually had to reinvent. We couldn't just take those UIs and shoehorn them into Windows Phone. We had to rethink the entire process. So, okay, the scanning experience, as I said, we knew that scanning was going to be a challenge, and I did some UX tricks to try and make it. If it's not going to be faster, damn it, let's make it at least feel faster. So what I did is when they jump into the deliveries section, what I observed, the fact of what they wanted to do, was they wanted to scan. The first thing they wanted to do was actually scan something. But what I did is I actually didn't show them the scan interface. I pushed them into the tasks interface first, because I wanted to preload the camera, so that when they swipe to the camera, they would immediately see it live. At first prototypes, when we went straight to the camera, it took a few seconds to load and it just felt slow. And so this kind of rectified that feeling of being slow, although it is actually the same. There's no difference there. The next thing that we did is when I started playing around with the high fidelities or the final screen mock-ups, I was playing around with the photo in the background, and I realized, man, they're not here to take a selfie, or they're not trying to take a photo on Facebook or something like that. So why don't we just grayscale it? A, we can really highlight that infrared shot to make it easy for them to see where they're scanning. And B, the RMX packages are red. So imagine you want to have a red bar, it's not going to work. So we grayscaled the background and made it a little bit easier for them to just get their task done. And we did a whole bunch of smart scanning logic. So we did a bunch of the RMX have unique barcodes. And so we didn't want just, imagine like there was a bit of a reflection on the end and they couldn't take the last number. So we wouldn't even take that scan until we validated that it was a proper RMX barcode. And the final thing that we did is because they needed to peel the cover back to actually hit that barcode, we made it, once they tap it, it will just continuously automatically try to scan and find that code. The final trick that we did to really improve the scanning or try and speed it up as much as we could was when they actually went to a customer and they scanned the first package for the customer, it's quite often that they would have to deliver multiple packages to that customer. So rather than asking them to scan all the packages, we just said, hey, look, there's three other packages there. Would you like to add them to this order? And that's kind of some of the strategies that we did to get around that. So I spent a lot of time sweating over these designs and not just in my own little world doing them, but every design, as I said, I was constantly involving the RMX team, the stakeholders, the various management, the IT departments, and of course the couriers themselves, always validating my design as I went on. So we're really proud of the result. I think that, you know, when you look at this application, this is essentially a line of business application, but it wouldn't feel too far at home from a consumer app. You look at this and it looks easy, intuitive, and in fact, when we did roll it out, I'm pleased to say that it has been rolled out globally now, so couriers all over the world, RMX couriers all over the world are using it, and the feedback has been awesome. Like, they just said, look, we don't need any training manuals, we're just jumping in and we're using this product. And we really had a challenge up against us, so really glad that we were able to achieve that. So good UX was absolutely critical to getting this working. Like I said, we had hardware limitations, so the only thing that was going to save us was a good overall experience. And it was awesome that we were able to really revolutionize the way, like I say here, you can see that we've consolidated all of their devices into this one smartphone, and it's not even a rugged smartphone, it's a cheap device. Okay, so the final point that I wanted to talk about today was validating results. It's all good and fine to show screens to stakeholders and show screens to like the design documents and this back and forth, but at the end of the day, it's really critical that you include real end users and test end users as early as possible. So user testing. Sorry, guys, getting a really dry throat. So typically, when we think of user testing, we're thinking this kind of setup, and we're thinking management are thinking super expensive. We don't have the skills. We don't have the people. We don't have the team. Cameras and like double glass rooms and all this kind of really complicated stuff. It doesn't have to be that way. And I encourage you have to have some form of user testing, and it could be something as simple as this. I mean, there's no excuse not for putting UIs in front of end users. This is a great example. Cut out a whole bunch of cards. Once you finish the high fidelity process, cut out a whole bunch of cards and just ask open-ended questions of how do you get a specific task done, and just swap cards out. Click this button. Sorry, give it. It's just kindergarten stuff, right? Like, we don't have to spend a lot of money. And this is going to hugely help support and validate the solutions that we're coming up with. And okay, if the kindergarten stuff is a little bit too low-key or too low-tech for you guys, you can also do various mock-ups. And so this is something that we're currently working with RMX to port that to Android, and we wanted to validate that the Android design was going to be intuitively understood by the users. And so we just put together, using Visio and wireframing tools, this basic mock-up. There's no code here. We use Balsamiq and Visio to come up with this quick sketch of how it could look like, and this is actually one of the users clicking through and looking at the experience, and not a single line of code was written, and I could validate that, did they understand this design? Are they comfortable with this design? And so really there's no excuse not to test your ideas. So it's Friday, it's almost the end of Tech Ed, let's just recap what we talked about today. So we talked about modern UI design principles and the importance of modern UI design principles, and now the fact that it's a ubiquitous thing. If you're building on iOS, on the web, Android, Windows 10, we need to understand these design principles. The benefits of coming up with a minimum viable product and listening to feedback and iterating rapidly to find success. We talked about Windows 10 and the challenges of building a hybrid app and having to think about all the different screens and all the different experiences that your apps are being used. And we talked about design process and how, when you aren't intimately involved with the end user, how do you get information from a client? What design process works there? And we discussed the consumerization of enterprise software, something that I'm very passionate about. And then finally, we discussed solving unfamiliar problems, problems that we have no idea about. What kind of processes can we do? And we used something like contextual inquiry to really go there and understand their needs. And finally, we finished off with validating results with user testing. User testing does not have to be expensive. It does not have to be difficult. Don't put barriers to actually getting your designs out in front of users as quickly as possible. So thank you so much for putting up with my session. I hope you enjoyed it. And here's some related content. Today is obviously Friday, so a lot of it's already finished. And there's don't forget to complete your session. If you liked it, rate it. If you didn't like it as well, I'd also like to hear, because I'm always looking to improve. And thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming.